By the beginning of 1941, they were exceedingly anxious to draw Japan into the war, not against America, not even against Russia, which they were shortly to attack, but against Britain, which had refused to give in even when apparently beaten. Early in 1941, German pressure on Japan was stepped up. On February 23rd, Ribbentrop received at his stolen estate at Fushel, near Salzburg, the fiery and hot-tempered Japanese ambassador, General Hiroshi Oshima, who had often impressed this observer as more Nazi than the Nazis. Though the war, Ribbentrop told his guest, was already won, Japan should come in as soon as possible in its own interest and seize Britain's empire in Asia. A surprise intervention by Japan, he continued, was bound to keep America out of the war. America, which at present is not armed and would hesitate to expose her navy to any risks west of Hawaii, could do this even less in such a case. If Japan would otherwise respect the American interests, there would not even be the possibility for Roosevelt to use the argument of lost prestige to make war plausible to the Americans. It was very unlikely that America would declare war if it had to stand by while Japan took the Philippines. But even if the United States did get involved, Ribbentrop declared, this would not endanger the final victory of the countries of the three-power pact. The Japanese fleet would easily defeat the American fleet, and the war would be brought rapidly to an end with the fall of both Britain and America. This was heady stuff for the fire-eating Japanese envoy, and Ribbentrop poured it on. He advised the Japanese to be firm and use plain language in their current negotiations in Washington. Only if the U.S. realized that they were confronting firm determination would they hold back. The people in the U.S. were not willing to sacrifice their sons, and therefore were against any entry into the war. The American people felt instinctively that they were being drawn into war for no reason by Roosevelt and the Jewish wire pullers. Therefore, our policies with the U.S. should be plain and firm. The Nazi foreign minister had one warning to give, the one that had failed so dismally with Franco. If Germany should ever weaken, Japan would find itself confronted by a world coalition within a short time. We are all in the same boat. The fate of both countries was being determined now for centuries to come. A defeat of Germany would also mean the end of the Japanese imperialist idea. To acquaint his military commanders and the top men in the Foreign Office with his new Japanese policy, Hitler issued on March 5, 1941, a top-secret directive entitled Basic Order No. 24 regarding collaboration with Japan. It must be the aim of the collaboration based on the Three Power Pact to induce Japan as soon as possible to take active measures in the Far East. Strong British forces will thereby be tied down, and the center of gravity of the interests of the United States will be diverted to the Pacific. The common aim of the conduct of war is to be stressed as forcing England to her knees quickly and thereby keeping the United States out of the war. The seizure of Singapore as the key British position in the Far East would mean a decisive success for the entire conduct of war of the three powers. Hitler also urged the Japanese seizure of other British naval bases and even American bases if the entry of the United States into the war cannot be prevented. He concluded by ordering that the Japanese must not be given any intimation of the Barbarossa operation. The Japanese ally, like the Italian ally, was to be used to further German ambitions, but neither government would be taken into the Führer's confidence regarding his intention to attack Russia. A fortnight later, on March 18th, at a conference with Hitler, Keitel, and Jodl, Admiral Raeder strongly urged that Japan be pressed to attack Singapore. The opportunity would never again be so favorable, Raeder explained, what with the whole English fleet contained, the unpreparedness of the USA for war against Japan, and the inferiority of the U.S. fleet compared to the Japanese. The capture of Singapore, the admiral said, would solve all the other Asiatic questions regarding the USA and England, and would of course enable Japan to avoid war with America if she wished. There was only one hitch, the admiral opined, and mention of it must have made Hitler frown. According to naval intelligence, Raeder warned, Japan would move against the British in Southeast Asia only if Germany proceeds to land in England. There is no record in the Navy minutes of this meeting indicating what reply Hitler made to this remark. Raeder certainly knew that the Supreme Commander had neither plans nor hopes for a landing in England this year. Raeder said something else that the Führer did not respond to. He recommended that Matsuoka be advised regarding the designs on Russia. The Japanese foreign minister was now on his way to Berlin via Siberia and Moscow, uttering bellicose pro-Axis statements, as Secretary of State Hull put it, along the route. Hull made the remark to the new Japanese ambassador in Washington, Admiral Nomura, in the presence of Mr. Roosevelt on March 14th. Nomura replied that Matsuoka talked loudly for home consumption because he was ambitious politically. The Memoirs of Cordell Hull, Volume 2, pages 900 to 901. His arrival in the German capital on March 26th came at an awkward moment for Hitler, for that night the pro-German Yugoslav government was overthrown in the Belgrade coup, and the Führer was so busy improvising plans to crush the obstreperous Balkan country that he had to postpone seeing the Japanese visitor until the afternoon of the 27th. Ribbentrop saw him in the morning, playing over, so to speak, the old gramophone records reserved for such guests on such occasions. Though managing to be even more fatuous than usual and not allowing the dapper little Matsuoka to get in a word. The lengthy confidential minutes drawn up by Dr. Schmidt, and now among the captured Foreign Office papers, leave no doubt of that. "The war has already been definitely won by the Axis," Ribbentrop announced, "and it is only a question of time before England admits it." In the next breath, he was urging a quick attack upon Singapore, because it would be a very decisive factor in the speedy overthrow of England. In the face of such a contradiction, the diminutive Japanese visitor did not bat an eye. He sat there inscrutably, Schmidt later remembered, in no way revealing how these curious remarks impressed him. As to America, "There was no doubt," Ribbentrop said, "that the British would long since have abandoned the war if Roosevelt had not always given Churchill new hope. The three-power pact had above all had the goal of frightening America and of keeping it out of the war. America had to be prevented by all possible means from taking an active part in the war and from making its aid to England too effective. The capture of Singapore would perhaps be most likely to keep America out of the war because the United States could scarcely risk sending its fleet into Japanese waters. Roosevelt would be in a very difficult position." Though Hitler had laid it down that Matsuoka must not be told about the impending German attack on Russia, a necessary precaution to keep the news from leaking out, but nevertheless, as we shall see, one that would have disastrous consequences for Germany, Ribbentrop did drop several broad hints. Relations with the Soviet Union, he told his visitor, were correct but not very friendly. Moreover, should Russia threaten Germany, the Führer would crush Russia. The Führer was convinced, he added, that if it came to war, there would be in a few months no more Russia. Matsuoka, says Schmidt, blinked at this and looked alarmed, whereupon Ribbentrop hastened to assure him that he did not believe that Stalin would pursue an unwise policy. At this juncture, says Schmidt, Ribbentrop was called away by Hitler to discuss the Yugoslav crisis and failed even to return for the official lunch which he was supposed to tender the distinguished visitor. In the afternoon, Hitler, having determined to smash another country, Yugoslavia, worked on the Japanese foreign minister. "England has already lost the war," he began. "It is only a matter of having the intelligence to admit it. Still, the British were grasping at two straws, Russia and America." Toward the Soviet Union, Hitler was more circumspect than Ribbentrop had been. He did not believe, he said, that the danger of a war with Russia would arise. After all, Germany had some 160 to 170 divisions for defense against Russia. As to the United States, America was confronted by three possibilities. She could arm herself, she could assist England, or she could wage war on another front. If she helped England, she could not arm herself. If she abandoned England, the latter would be destroyed, and America would then find herself fighting the powers of the three-power pact alone. In no case, however, could America wage war on another front. Therefore, the Führer concluded, never in the human imagination could there be a better opportunity for the Japanese to strike in the Pacific than now. "Such a moment," he said, laying it on as thickly as he could, "would never return. It was unique in history." Matsuoka agreed, but reminded Hitler that unfortunately he did not control Japan. At the moment, he could make no pledge on behalf of the Japanese Empire that it would take action. But Hitler, being absolute dictator, could make a pledge, and he made it to Japan. quite casually and without being asked to, on April 4th, after Matsuoka had returned to Berlin from seeing Mussolini. Mussolini had told him, he informed Hitler, that America was the number one enemy, and Soviet Russia came only in second place. This second meeting took place on the eve of the Nazi attack on two more innocent countries, Yugoslavia and Greece, and the Führer, thirsting for further easy conquests and for revenge on Belgrade, was in one of his warlike moods. While he considered war with the United States undesirable, he said, he had already included it in his calculations. But he did not think much of America's military power, or of anything else about the United States. His weird conception of America, by this time Hitler had come to believe his own Nazi propaganda, was given further exposition in a talk he had with Mussolini at the Russian front late in August 1941. The Führer, the Italian records quote him indirectly as saying, gave a detailed account of the Jewish clique which surrounds Roosevelt and exploits the American people. He stated that he could not for anything in the world live in a country like the USA, whose conceptions of life are inspired by the most grasping commercialism, and which does not love any of the loftiest expressions of the human spirit, such as music. Chano's Diplomatic Papers, pages 449-452. Germany had made her preparations so that no American could land in Europe. Germany would wage a vigorous war against America with U-boats and the Luftwaffe, and with her greater experience would be more than a match for America, entirely apart from the fact that German soldiers were obviously far superior to the Americans. This boast led him to make the fateful pledge. Schmidt recorded it in his minutes. If Japan got into a conflict with the United States, Germany, on her part, would take the necessary steps at once. From Schmidt's notes, it is evident that Matsuoka did not quite grasp the significance of what the Führer was promising, so Hitler said it again. Germany, as he had said, would promptly take part in case of a conflict between Japan and America. Hitler paid dearly not only for this assurance, so casually given, but for his deceit in not telling the Japanese about his intention to attack Russia as soon as the Balkans were occupied. Somewhat coyly, Matsuoka had asked Ribbentrop during a talk on March 28th whether on his return trip he should remain in Moscow in order to negotiate with the Russians on the Non-Aggression Pact or the Treaty of Neutrality. The dull-witted Nazi foreign minister had replied smugly that Matsuoka, if possible, should not bring up the question in Moscow, since it probably would not altogether fit into the framework of the present situation. He did not quite grasp the significance of what was up. But by the next day it had penetrated his wooden mind, and he began the conversations that day by referring to it. First of all, he threw in, as casually as Hitler would do on April 4th, a German guarantee that if Russia attacked Japan, Germany would strike immediately. He wanted to give this assurance, he said, so that Japan could push southward toward Singapore without fear of any complications with Russia. When Matsuoka finally admitted that while in Moscow on his way to Berlin, he himself had proposed a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, and hinted that the Russians were favorably inclined toward it, Ribbentrop's mind again became somewhat of a blank. He merely advised that Matsuoka handle the problem in a superficial way. But as soon as the Nipponese foreign minister was back in Moscow on his trip home, he signed a treaty of neutrality with Stalin, which, as Ambassador von der Schulenburg, who foresaw its consequences, wired Berlin, provided for each country to remain neutral in case the other got involved in the war. This was one treaty, it was signed on April 13th, which Japan honored to the very last, despite subsequent German exhortations that she disregard it. For before the summer of 1941 was out, the Nazis would be begging the Japanese to attack not Singapore or Manila, but Vladivostok. At first, however, Hitler did not grasp the significance of the Russo-Japanese Neutrality Pact. On April 20th, he told Admiral Raeder, who inquired about it, that it had been made with Germany's acquiescence, and that he welcomed it because Japan is now restrained from taking action against Vladivostok and should be induced to attack Singapore instead. News of the signing in Moscow of the Soviet-Japanese Neutrality Pact caused considerable alarm in Washington, where Roosevelt and Hull were inclined to take a view similar to Hitler's, namely, that the treaty would release Japanese forces earmarked for a possible war with Russia for action farther south against British and perhaps American possessions. Sherwood discloses that on April 13th, when the news of the conclusion of the pact was received, the President scrapped a plan for launching aggressive action by U.S. naval ships against German U-boats in the Western Atlantic. A new order called merely for American warships to report movements of German naval vessels west of Iceland, not to shoot at them. It was considered that the new Japanese-Soviet neutrality agreement made the situation in the Pacific too dangerous to risk too much in the Atlantic. Robert E. Sherwood, Roosevelt and Hopkins, page 291. At this stage, Hitler was confident Germany could destroy Russia during the summer. He did not want Japan to share in this mighty feat, any more than he had desired that Italy should share in the conquest of France. And he was absolutely confident that Japanese help would not be needed. Ribbentrop, echoing his master's thoughts, had told Matsuoka on March 29th that if Russia forced Germany to strike, he would consider it proper if the Japanese army were prevented from attacking Russia. But the views of Hitler and Ribbentrop on this matter changed very suddenly and quite drastically, scarcely 3 months later. 6 days after the Nazi armies were flung into Russia, on June 28, 1941, Ribbentrop was cabling the German ambassador in Tokyo, General Eugen Ott, to do everything he could to get the Japanese to promptly attack Soviet Russia in the rear. Ott was advised to appeal to the Japanese appetite for spoils and also to argue that this was the best way of keeping America neutral. It may be expected, Ribbentrop explained, that the rapid defeat of Soviet Russia, especially should Japan take action in the East, will prove the best argument to convince the United States of the utter futility of entering the war on the side of a Great Britain entirely isolated and confronted by the most powerful alliance in the world. Matsuoka was in favor of immediately turning on Russia, but his views were not accepted by the government in Tokyo, whose attitude seemed to be that if the Germans were rapidly defeating the Russians, as they claimed, they needed no help from the Japanese. However, Tokyo was not so sure about a lightning Nazi victory, and this was the real reason for its stand. But Ribbentrop persisted. On July 10th, when the German offensive in Russia was really beginning to roll, and even Halder, as we have seen, thought that victory already had been won, the Nazi foreign minister got off from his special train on the Eastern Front a new and stronger cable to his ambassador in Tokyo. Since Russia, as reported by the Japanese ambassador in Moscow, is in effect close to collapse, it is simply impossible that Japan does not solve the matter of Vladivostok and the Siberian area as soon as her military preparations are completed. I ask you to employ all available means in further insisting upon Japan's entry into the war against Russia at the soonest possible date. The sooner this entry is effected, the better it is. The natural objective still remains that we and Japan join hands on the Trans-Siberian Railroad before winter starts. Such a giddy prospect did not turn the head of even the militaristic Japanese government. 4 days later, Ambassador Ott replied that he was doing his best to persuade the Japanese to attack Russia as soon as possible, that Matsuoka was all for it, but that he, Ott, had to fight against great obstacles in the Tokyo cabinet. As a matter of fact, the fire-eating Matsuoka was soon forced out of the cabinet. With his departure, Germany lost, for the time being, its best friend. And though, as we shall see, closer relations were later restored between Berlin and Tokyo, they never became close enough to convince the Japanese of the wisdom of helping Germany in the war against Russia. Once more, Hitler had been bested at his own game by a wily ally. Ribbentrop kept trying all that fall and several times during the next 2 years to induce the Japanese to fall upon Russia from the rear, but each time the Tokyo government replied politely, in effect, "So sorry, please." Hitler himself remained hopeful all through the summer. On August 26th, he told Raeder he was convinced that Japan will carry out the attack on Vladivostok as soon as forces have been assembled. The present aloofness can be explained by the fact that the assembling of forces is to be accomplished undisturbed, and the attack is to come as a surprise. The Japanese archives reveal how Tokyo evaded the Germans on this embarrassing question. When, for instance, on August 19th, Ambassador Ott asked the Japanese Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs about Japan's intervention against Russia, the latter replied, "For Japan to do a thing like attacking Russia would be a very serious question and would require profound reflection." When on August 30th, Ott, who by now was a very irritated ambassador, asked Foreign Minister Admiral Toyoda Is there any possibility that Japan may participate in the Russo-German War? Toyoda replied, Japan's preparations are now making headway, and it will take more time for their completion. Avoid incidents with the USA. With Japan stubbornly refusing to help pull Hitler's chestnuts out of the fire in Russia, the Japanese had their own chestnuts roasting. It became all the more important to Germany that the United States be kept out of the war until the Soviet Union had been conquered, as the Führer was confident that summer of 1941 it would be before winter came. The German Navy had long chafed under the restraints which Hitler had imposed on its efforts to curtail American shipments to Britain and to cope with the increasing belligerency of U.S. warships toward German U-boats and surface craft operating in the Atlantic. The Nazi admirals, looking further afield than Hitler's landlocked mind was capable of doing, had almost from the first regarded America's entry into the war as inevitable, and they had urged the Supreme Commander to prepare for it. Immediately after the fall of France in June 1940, Admiral Raeder, backed by Goering, had urged Hitler to seize not only French West Africa, but, more important, the Atlantic Islands, including Iceland, the Azores, and the Canaries, to prevent the United States from occupying them. Hitler had expressed interest, but he first wanted to invade England and conquer Russia. Then the upstart Americans, their position rendered hopeless, would be taken care of. A top-secret memorandum of Major Freiherr von Falkenstein, of the General Staff, discloses Hitler's views at the end of the summer in 1940. The Führer is at present occupied with the question of the occupation of the Atlantic Islands with a view to the prosecution of war against America at a later date. Deliberations on this subject are being embarked on here. It was not a question, then, of whether or not Hitler intended to go to war against the United States, but of the date he would choose to embark on it. By the following spring, the date was beginning to sprout in the Führer's mind. On May 22, 1941, Admiral Raeder conferred with the Supreme Commander and reported ruefully that the Navy must reject the idea of occupying the Azores. It simply didn't have the strength. But by this time, Hitler had warmed to the project and, according to Raeder's confidential notes, replied, The Führer is still in favor of occupying the Azores in order to be able to operate long-range bombers from there against the USA. The occasion for this may arise by autumn. The Germans had no long-range bombers capable of reaching the American coast from the Azores, much less getting back, and it is a sign of the warping of Hitler's mind by this time that he conjured up the non-existent long-range bombers. After the fall of the Soviet Union, that is. The turn of the United States would come then. He put this clearly to Raeder when the admiral saw him just 2 months later on July 25th, when the offensive in Russia was in full swing. After the Eastern Campaign, Raeder notes him as saying, he reserves the right to take severe action against the USA. But until then, Hitler emphasized to his Navy chief, he wanted to avoid having the USA declare war out of consideration for the Army, which is involved in heavy combat. Raeder was not satisfied with this stand. In fact, his diary accounts of his meetings with Hitler, which one can now peruse in the captured documents, show his growing impatience at the wraps which the Führer had placed on the German Navy. At every interview, he sought to change the leader's mind. Early that year, on February 4th, Raeder submitted a memorandum to Hitler in which the Navy expressed strong doubts about the value of continued American neutrality, as it was working out, to Germany. In fact, the admirals argued that America's entry into the war might even prove advantageous for the German war effort if Japan thereby became a belligerent on the side of the Axis. But the Nazi dictator was not impressed by the argument. Raeder was greatly discouraged. The Battle of the Atlantic was at its height, and Germany was not winning it. American supplies under the Lend-Lease Agreement were pouring into Britain. The Pan-American Neutrality Patrol was making it more and more difficult for the U-boats to be effective. All this Raeder pointed out to Hitler, but without much effect. He saw the leader again on March 18th and reported that U.S. warships were escorting American convoys bound for Britain as far as Iceland. He demanded authority to attack them without warning. He asked that something be done to prevent the USA from gaining a foothold in French West Africa. This possibility, he said, was most dangerous. Hitler listened and said he would discuss these matters with the Foreign Office, of all places, which was one way of putting the admirals off. All through the spring and early summer, he continued to put them off. On April 20th, he refused to listen to Raider's pleas for warfare against merchant ships of the USA, according to prize regulations. The first recorded clash between American and German war vessels had occurred on April 10th, when the U.S. destroyer Niblack dropped depth charges on a German U-boat which showed signs of attacking. On May 22nd, Raider was back at the Berghof with a long memorandum suggesting countermeasures to President Roosevelt's unfriendly acts, but he could not move his supreme commander. The Führer, the admiral noted, considers the attitude of the President of the United States still undecided. Under no circumstances does he wish to cause incidents which would result in U.S. entry into the war. There was all the more reason to avoid such incidents when the campaign in Russia began, and on June 21st, the day before the attack commenced, Hitler emphasized this to Raider. The Grand Admiral had given him a glowing account of how the U-253, spotting the U.S. battleship Texas and an accompanying destroyer within the blockade zone in the North Atlantic proclaimed by Germany, had chased and attempted to attack them, and had added that, where the USA is concerned, firm measures are always more effective than apparent yielding. The Führer agreed with the principle, but not with the specific action, and once more he admonished the Navy. The Führer declares in detail that until Operation Barbarossa is well underway, he wishes to avoid any incident with the USA. After a few weeks, the situation will become clearer and can be expected to have a favorable effect on the USA and Japan. America will have less inclination to enter the war due to the threat from Japan, which will then increase. If possible, therefore, in the next weeks, all attacks on naval vessels in the closed area should cease. When Raider attempted to argue that at night it was difficult to distinguish enemy from neutral warships, Hitler cut him short by instructing him to issue new orders to avoid incidents with America. As a result, the Navy chief sent out orders the same night calling off attacks on any naval vessels inside or outside the closed area, unless they were definitely identified as British. A similar order was given the Luftwaffe. On July 9th, President Roosevelt announced that American forces were taking over the occupation of Iceland from the British. The reaction in Berlin was immediate and violent. Ribbentrop cabled Tokyo that this intrusion of American military forces in support of England into a territory which has been officially proclaimed by us to be a combat area is in itself an aggression against Germany and Europe. Raider hurried to Wulfschanze, from where the Führer was directing his armies in Russia. He wanted a decision, he said, on whether the occupation of Iceland by the USA is to be considered as an entry into the war or as an act of provocation which should be ignored. As for the German Navy, it considered the American landings in Iceland an act of war, and in a two-page memorandum it reminded the Führer of all the other acts of aggression against Germany committed by the Roosevelt government. Moreover, the Navy demanded the right to sink American freighters in the convoy area and to attack U.S. warships if the occasion required it. It might be noted here that, on the stand at Nuremberg, Admiral Raider insisted that he did everything possible to avoid provoking the United States into war. Hitler refused. The Führer explains in detail, Raider's report on the meeting declares, that he is most anxious to postpone the United States' entry into the war for another 1 or 2 months. On the one hand, the Eastern campaign must be carried on with the entire Air Force, which he does not wish to divert even in part. On the other hand, a victorious campaign on the Eastern Front will have a tremendous effect on the whole situation and probably on the attitude of the USA. Therefore, for the time being, he does not wish the existing instructions changed, but rather wants to be sure that incidents will be avoided. When Raider argued that his naval commanders could not be held responsible for a mistake if American ships were hit, Hitler retorted that at least in regard to war vessels, the Navy had better definitely establish that they were enemy craft before attacking. To make sure that the admirals understood him correctly, the Führer issued a specific order on July 19th stipulating that in the extended zone of operations, U.S. merchant ships, whether single or sailing in English or American convoys, and if recognized as such before resort to arms, are not to be attacked. Within the blockade area, which was also recognized by the United States as being out of bounds, American vessels could be attacked, but Hitler specifically laid it down in this order that this war zone did not include the USA-Iceland sea route. But mistakes, as Raider said, were bound to occur. On May 21st, a U-boat had sunk the American freighter Robin Moore en route to South Africa and at a place well outside the German blockade zone. Two more American merchant vessels were torpedoed toward the end of the summer. On September 4th, a German submarine fired two torpedoes at the U.S. destroyer Greer, both missing. A week later, on September 11th, Roosevelt reacted to this attack in a speech in which he announced that he had given orders to the Navy to shoot on sight and warned that Axis warships entering the American defense zone did so at their peril. The speech incensed Berlin. In the Nazi press, Roosevelt was attacked as warmonger number one. Ribbentrop recalled at Nuremberg that Hitler was greatly excited. However, by the time Admiral Raeder arrived at the Wolfschanze headquarters on the Eastern Front on the afternoon of September 17th to urge a drastic retaliation to the shoot-on-sight order, the Führer had calmed down. To the Admiral's plea that the German Navy at least be released from the restrictions against attacking American ships, the Supreme Commander again gave a firm no. Since it appears that the end of September will bring the great decision in the Russian campaign, Raeder's record of the conversation declares, the Führer requests that care be taken to avoid any incidents in the war on merchant shipping before about the middle of October. Therefore, Raeder noted sadly, the Commander-in-Chief, Navy, and the Commanding Admiral submarines, Dönitz, withdraw their suggestions. The submarines are to be informed of the reason for temporarily keeping to the old orders. In view of the circumstances, Hitler was certainly behaving with unaccustomed restraint. But admittedly, it was more difficult for the young U-boat commanders, operating in the stormy waters of the North Atlantic and constantly harassed by increasingly effective British anti-submarine measures, in which U.S. war vessels sometimes joined, to restrain themselves. Hitler had told Raeder in July that he would never call a submarine skipper to account if he sank an American ship by mistake. On November 9th, in his annual address to the Nazi Old Guard at the familiar beer cellar in Munich, he answered Roosevelt's speech. President Roosevelt has ordered his ships to shoot the moment they sight German ships. I have ordered German ships not to shoot when they sight American vessels, but to defend themselves when attacked. I will have any German officer court-martialed who fails to defend himself. And on November 13th, he issued a new directive ordering that while engagements with American warships were to be avoided as far as possible, German submarines must defend themselves against attack. They had, of course, already done that. On the night of October 16th to 17th, the U.S. destroyer Kearney, coming to the aid of a convoy which was being attacked by German submarines, dropped depth charges on one of them, which retaliated by torpedoing it. 11 men of the crew were killed. These were the first American casualties in the undeclared war with Germany. More were to quickly follow. On October 31st, the U.S. destroyer Reuben James was torpedoed and sunk while on convoy duty, with the loss of 100 men of 145 in its crew, including all its 7 officers. Thus, long before the final formalities of declaring war, a shooting war had begun. History has recorded who fired the first shot, Roosevelt declared in reference to this incident in a Navy Day speech on October 27th. In all fairness, it would seem that in dropping depth charges, the United States fired the first shot. According to the confidential German Navy records, this was not the first such occasion. The official U.S. naval historian confirms that as early as April 10th, the Niblack attacked a U-boat with depth charges. Samuel Elliott Morrison, History of the United States Naval Operations in World War II, Volume 1, page 57. Japan plays its own game. Japan, as we have seen, had been assigned by Hitler the role not of bringing the United States into the war, but of keeping her, at least for the time being, out of it. He knew that if the Japanese took Singapore and threatened India, this would not only be a severe blow to the British, but would divert America's attention and some of her energies from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Even after he began begging the Japanese to attack Vladivostok, he saw in this a means not only to help him bring Russia down, but to further pressure the United States into remaining neutral. Strangely enough, it never seems to have occurred to him or to anyone else in Germany until very late that Japan had her own fish to fry, and that the Japanese might be fearful of embarking on a grand offensive in Southeast Asia against the British and Dutch, not to mention attacking Russia in the rear, until they had secured their own rear by destroying the United States Pacific Fleet. True, the Nazi conqueror had promised Matsuoka that Germany would go to war with America if Japan did, but Matsuoka was no longer in the government, and besides, Hitler had constantly nagged the Japanese to avoid a direct conflict with America and concentrate on Britain and the Soviet Union, whose resistance was preventing him from winning the war. It did not dawn on the Nazi rulers that Japan might give first priority to a direct challenge to the United States. Not that Berlin wanted the Japanese and Americans to reach an understanding. That would defeat the main purpose of the Tripartite Pact, which was to frighten the Americans into staying out of the war. For once, Ribbentrop probably gave an honest and accurate appraisal of the Führer's thoughts on this when he told an interrogator at Nuremberg. He, Hitler, was afraid that if an arrangement were made between the United States and Japan, this would mean, so to speak, the back free for America, and an unexpected attack or entry into the war by the United States would come quicker. He was worried about an agreement because there were certain groups in Japan who wanted to come to an arrangement with America. One member of such a group was Admiral Kichisaburo Nomura, who arrived in Washington in February 1941 as the new Japanese ambassador, and whose series of confidential conversations with Cordell Hull, which began in March, with the aim of settling peacefully the differences between the two countries, and which continued right up to the end, gave considerable worry to Berlin. "I credit Nomura," Hull wrote later in his memoirs, "with having been honestly sincere in trying to avoid war between his country and mine." The Memoirs of Cordell Hull, Volume 2, page 987. In fact, the Germans did their best to sabotage the Washington talks. As early as May 15, 1941, Weizsäcker submitted a memorandum to Ribbentrop pointing out that any political treaty between Japan and the United States is undesirable at the present, and arguing that unless it were prevented, Japan might be lost to the Axis. General Ott, the Nazi ambassador in Tokyo, called frequently at the Foreign Office to warn against the Hull-Nomura negotiations. When, in spite of this, they continued, the Germans switched to a new maneuver of trying to induce the Japanese to make as a condition for their continuation that the United States abandon its aid to Britain and its hostile policies toward Germany. That was in May. The summer brought a change. In July, Hitler was concerned mainly with badgering Japan into attacking the Soviet Union. And that month, Secretary Hull broke off the talks with Nomura because the Japanese had invaded French Indochina. They were resumed toward the middle of August when the Japanese government proposed a personal meeting between Premier Prince Konoye and President Roosevelt for the purpose of arriving at a peaceful settlement. This did not please Berlin at all, and the indefatigable Ott was soon at the Tokyo Foreign Office expressing Nazi displeasure with this turn of events. Both Foreign Minister Admiral Toyoda and Vice Minister Amao told him blandly that the proposed Konoye-Roosevelt talks would merely advance the purpose of the Tripartite Pact, which, they reminded him, was to prevent American participation in the war. In the autumn, as the Hull-Nomura talks continued, the Wilhelmstrasse switched back to the old tactics of the spring. It insisted in Tokyo that Nomura be instructed to warn the United States that if it continued its unfriendly acts toward the European Axis, Germany and Italy might have to declare war, and that in this case Japan, under the terms of the Tripartite Pact, would have to join them. Hitler still did not want America in the war. The move was made, in fact, to bluff Washington into staying out while at the same time affording some relief from American belligerency in the Atlantic. Secretary Hull learned immediately of this new German pressure, thanks to magic, as it was called, which since the end of 1940 had enabled the American government to decode intercepted Japanese cable and wireless messages in Tokyo's most secret ciphers. Not only those sent to and from Washington, but those to and from Berlin and other capitals. The German demand was cabled by Toyoda to Nomura on October 16, 1941, along with instructions to present a watered-down version to Hull. That day, the Konoye government fell and was replaced by a military cabinet headed by the hot-headed, belligerent General Hideki Tojo. In Berlin, General Oshima, a warrior of similar caste, hastened to the Wilhelmstrasse to explain the good news to the German government. Tojo's appearance at the post as premier meant, the ambassador said, that Japan would draw closer to its Axis partners and that the talks in Washington would cease. Whether on purpose or not, he neglected to tell his Nazi friends what the consequences of the cessation of those talks must be, and that Tojo's appointment therefore meant a good deal more than they suspected, namely, that his new government was determined to go to war with the United States unless the Washington negotiations swiftly ended with President Roosevelt accepting the Japanese terms for a free hand, not to attack Russia, but to occupy Southeast Asia. This course had never entered the minds of Ribbentrop and Hitler, who still envisaged Japan as useful and helpful to German interests only if she attacked Siberia and Singapore and frightened Washington into worrying about the Pacific and staying out of the war. The Führer and, of course, his doltish foreign minister had never understood that the failure of the Nomura Hull negotiations in Washington, which they so greatly desired, would bring the very result they had been trying to avoid until the time was ripe, America's entry into the world conflict. Prince Konoye's post-war memoirs reveal that as early as August 4th he was forced to agree to a demand of the army that if, in his proposed meeting with Roosevelt, the president did not accept Japan's terms, he would walk out of the meeting with a determination to make war on the United States. Hull, Memoirs, pages 1025 to 1026. The sands were now rapidly running out. On November 15th, Saburo Kurusu arrived in Washington as a special ambassador to aid Nomura in the negotiations, but Secretary Hull soon sensed that the diplomat, who as the Japanese envoy in Berlin had signed the Tripartite Pact and was somewhat pro-German, had brought no fresh proposals with him. His purpose, Hull thought, was to try to persuade Washington to accept the Japanese terms at once, or, if that failed, to lull the American government with talk until Japan was ready to strike a heavy surprise blow. On November 19th came the ominous winds message to Nomura from Tokyo, which Hull's cryptographers promptly deciphered. If the Japanese newscaster on the shortwave Tokyo broadcast, which the embassy picked up daily, inserted the words east wind, rain, that would mean that the Japanese government had decided on war with America. Nomura was instructed on receipt of the wind's warning to destroy all his codes and confidential papers. Now Berlin awoke to what was up. The day before the wind's message, on November 18th, Ribbentrop was somewhat surprised to receive a request from Tokyo asking Germany to sign a treaty in which the two nations would agree not to conclude a separate peace with common enemies. Just which enemies the Japanese meant was not clear, but the Nazi foreign minister obviously hoped that Russia was the first of them. He agreed in principle to the proposal, apparently in the comforting belief that Japan at last was about to honor its vague promises to hit the Soviet Union in Siberia. This was most welcome and timely, for the resistance of the Red Army on the broad front was becoming formidable, and the Russian winter was setting in, much earlier than had been anticipated. A Japanese attack on Vladivostok and the Pacific maritime provinces might provide that extra ounce of pressure which would bring a Soviet collapse. Ribbentrop was swiftly disillusioned. On November 23rd, Ambassador Ott wired him from Tokyo that all indications were that the Japanese were moving south with the intention of occupying Thailand and the Dutch-held Borneo oil fields, and that the Japanese government wanted to know if Germany would make common cause with her if she were to start a war. This information plainly meant that Japan would not strike against Russia, but was contemplating starting a war with the Netherlands and Britain in the South Pacific, which well might embroil her in an armed conflict with the United States. But Ribbentrop and Ott did not grasp the last point. Their exchanges of telegrams during these days show that though they now realized, to their disappointment, that Japan would not attack Russia, they believed that her move southward would be against the possessions of the Dutch and British, and not those of the United States. Uncle Sam, as Hitler desired, would be kept on the sidelines until his time came. Nazi misapprehensions were due in large part to the failure at this juncture of the Japanese to take the German government into their confidence as to their fateful decisions regarding America. Secretary Hull, thanks to the magic codebreaker, was much better informed. As early as November 5th, he knew that the new foreign minister, Shigenori Togo, had wired Nomura setting a deadline of November 25th for the signing of an agreement, on Japan's terms, with the American government. The final Japanese proposals were delivered in Washington on November 20th. Hull and Roosevelt knew they were final because 2 days later, magic decoded for them a message from Togo to Nomura and Kurusu, which said so, while extending the deadline to November 29th. "There are reasons beyond your ability to guess," Togo wired his ambassadors, "why we wanted to settle Japanese-American relations by the 25th. But if the signing can be completed by the 29th, we have decided to wait until that date. This time we mean it, that the deadline absolutely cannot be changed. After that, things are automatically going to happen. November 25, 1941 is a crucial date. On that day, the Japanese carrier task force sailed for Pearl Harbor. In Washington, Hull went to the White House to warn the War Council of the danger confronting the country from Japan and to stress to the U.S. Army and Navy chiefs the possibility of Japanese surprise attacks. In Berlin that day, there was a somewhat grotesque ceremony in which the three Axis powers, amid much pomp and ceremony, renewed the Anti-Comintern Pact of 1936, an empty gesture which, as some Germans noted, did absolutely nothing to get Japan into the war against Russia, but which afforded the pompous Ribbentrop an opportunity to denounce Roosevelt as the chief culprit of this war, and to shed crocodile tears for the truthful, religious American people betrayed by such an irresponsible leader. The Nazi foreign minister seems to have become intoxicated by his own words. He called in Oshima on the evening of November 28th, following a lengthy council of war earlier that day presided over by Hitler, and gave the Japanese ambassador the impression that the German attitude toward the United States, as Oshima promptly radioed Tokyo, had considerably stiffened. Hitler's policy of doing everything possible to keep America out of the war until Germany was ready to take her on seemed about to be jettisoned. Suddenly, Ribbentrop was urging the Japanese to go to war against the United States, as well as Britain, and promising the backing of the Third Reich. After warning Oshima that if Japan hesitates, all the military might of Britain and the United States will be concentrated against Japan, a rather silly thesis as long as the European war continued, Ribbentrop added, "As Hitler said today, there are fundamental differences in the very right to exist between Germany and Japan and the United States. We have received advice to the effect that there is practically no hope of the Japanese-U.S. negotiations being concluded successfully because the United States is putting up a stiff front. If this is indeed the fact of the case, and if Japan reaches a decision to fight Britain and the United States, I am confident that that not only will be in the interest of Germany and Japan jointly, but will bring about favorable results for Japan herself." The ambassador, a tense little man, was agreeably surprised, but he wanted to be sure he understood correctly. "Is Your Excellency," he asked, "indicating that a state of actual war is to be established between Germany and the United States?" Ribbentrop hesitated. Perhaps he had gone too far. "Roosevelt is a fanatic," he replied, "so it is impossible to tell what he would do." This seemed a strange and unsatisfactory answer to Oshima in view of what the foreign minister had said just before, and toward the end of the talk he insisted on coming back to the main point. What would Germany do if the war were actually extended to countries which have been aiding Britain? "Should Japan become engaged in a war against the United States," Ribbentrop replied, "Germany, of course, would join the war immediately. There is absolutely no possibility of Germany's entering into a separate peace with the United States under such circumstances. The Führer is determined on that point." This was the flat guarantee for which the Japanese government had been waiting. True, Hitler had given a similar one in the spring to Matsuoka, but it seemed to have been forgotten during the intervening period when he had become vexed at Japan's refusal to join in the war on Russia. All that remained now, so far as the Japanese were concerned, was to get the Germans to put their assurance in writing. General Oshima joyfully filed his report to Tokyo on November 29th. Fresh instructions reached him in Berlin the next day. The Washington talks, he was informed, now stand ruptured, broken. "Will Your Honor," the message directed, "therefore immediately interview Chancellor Hitler and Foreign Minister Ribbentrop, and confidentially communicate to them a summary of developments. Say to them that lately England and the United States have taken a provocative attitude, both of them. Say that they are planning to move military forces into various places in East Asia, and that we will inevitably have to counter by also moving troops. Say very secretly to them that there is extreme danger that war may suddenly break out between Japan and the Anglo-Saxon nations through some clash of arms, and add that the time of the breaking out of that war may come quicker than anyone dreams." Hull says that he received a copy of this message through magic. Thus Washington, as well as Berlin, knew by the last day of November that the Japanese might strike against the United States quicker than anyone dreamt. Hull, Memoirs, page 1092. The Japanese carrier fleet was now well on its way to Pearl Harbor. Tokyo was in a hurry to get Germany to sign. On the same day that Oshima was receiving his new instructions, November 30th, the Japanese foreign minister was conferring with the German ambassador in Tokyo, to whom he emphasized that the Washington talks had broken down because Japan refused to accede to American demands that she abandon the tripartite pact. The Japanese hoped the Germans would appreciate this sacrifice in a common cause. "Grave decisions are at stake," Togo told General Ott. "The United States is seriously preparing for war. Japan is not afraid of a breakdown in negotiations, and she hopes that in that case Germany and Italy, according to the three-power agreement, will stand at her side." "I answered," Ott radioed Berlin, "that there could be no doubt about Germany's future position. Japanese foreign minister thereupon stated that he understood from my words that Germany in such a case would consider her relationship to Japan as that of a community of fate. I answered, according to my opinion, Germany was certainly ready to have mutual agreement between the two countries on this situation." On the eve of Pearl Harbor, General Oshima was a great lover of German-Austrian classical music, and despite the gravity and tenseness of the situation, he took off for Austria to enjoy a Mozart festival. But he was not permitted to listen to the great Austrian composer's lovely music for long. An urgent call on December 1st brought him rushing back to his embassy in Berlin, where he found new instructions to get busy and sign up Germany on the dotted line. There was no time to lose. And now, when cornered, Ribbentrop stalled, apparently realizing fully for the first time the consequences of his rash promises to the Japanese. The Nazi foreign minister grew exceedingly cool and evasive. He told Oshima late on the evening of December 1st that he would first have to consult the Führer before making any definite commitment. The Japanese ambassador returned to the Wilhelmstrasse on Wednesday, the 3rd, to press his case, but again Ribbentrop put him off. To Oshima's pleas that the situation had become extremely critical, the foreign minister replied that while he personally was for a written agreement, the matter would have to wait until the Führer returned from headquarters later in the week. Actually, as Chano noted in his diary, not without a sign of glee, Hitler had flown to the southern front in Russia to see General von Kleist, whose armies continued to fall back under the pressure of an unexpected offensive. The Japanese, by this time, had also turned to Mussolini, who was not at any front. On December 3rd, the Japanese ambassador in Rome called on the Duce and formally asked Italy to declare war on the United States in accordance with the Tripartite Pact, as soon as the conflict with America should begin. The ambassador also wanted a treaty specifying that there would be no separate peace. The Japanese interpreter, Chano noted in his diary, was trembling like a leaf. As for the Duce, he was pleased to comply after consultation with Berlin. The German capital, Chano found the next day, had grown extremely cautious. "Maybe they will go ahead," he began his diary on December 4th, "because they can't do otherwise. But the idea of provoking American intervention is less and less liked by the Germans. Mussolini, on the other hand, is happy about it." Regardless of Ribbentrop's opinion, which Hitler surprisingly still paid some attention to, the decision as to whether Germany would give a formal guarantee to Japan could be taken only by the Nazi warlord himself. During the night of December 4th to 5th, the foreign minister apparently got the Führer's go-ahead. And at 3 a.m. he handed General Oshima a draft of the requested treaty in which Germany would join Japan in war against the United States and agree not to make a separate peace. Having taken the fateful plunge and followed his leader in reversing a policy that had been clung to stubbornly for 2 years, he could not refrain from seeing that his Italian ally promptly followed suit. "A night interrupted by Ribbentrop's restiveness," Chano began his diary on December 5th. "After having delayed 2 days, he now hasn't a minute to lose in answering the Japanese, and at 3 o'clock in the morning he sends Ambassador Mackensen to my house to submit a plan for a tripartite pact of Japanese intervention and the promise not to make a separate peace. They wanted me to wake up the Duce, but I did not do it, and the Duce was very pleased." The Japanese had a draft treaty approved by both Hitler and Mussolini, but they did not yet have it signed, and this worried them. They suspected that the Führer was stalling because he wanted a quid pro quo. If Germany joined Japan in the war against the United States, Japan would have to join Germany in the war against Russia. In his telegram of instructions to Oshima on November 30th, The Japanese foreign minister had given some advice on how to handle this ticklish problem if the Germans and Italians raised it. If they question you about our attitude toward the Soviet, say that we have already clarified our attitude toward the Russians in our statement of last July. Say that by our present moves southward we do not mean to relax our pressure against the Soviet, and that if Russia joins hands tighter with England and the United States and resists us with hostilities, we are ready to turn upon her with all our might. However, right now it is to our advantage to stress the South, and for the time being we would prefer to refrain from any direct moves in the North. December 6th came. Zhukov that very day launched his counteroffensive in front of Moscow, and the German armies reeled back in the snow and bitter cold. There was all the more reason for Hitler to demand his quid pro quo. On this question there was great uneasiness in the Foreign Office in Tokyo. The naval task force was now within flying distance of Pearl Harbor for its carrier planes. So far, miraculously, it had not been discovered by American ships or aircraft. But it might be any moment. A long message was being radioed from Tokyo to Nomura and Kurusu in Washington, instructing them to call on Secretary Hull at precisely 1 p.m. the next day, Sunday, December 7th, to present Japan's rejection of the latest American proposals, and stressing that the negotiations were de facto ruptured. In desperation, Tokyo turned to Berlin for a written guarantee of German support. The Japanese warlords still did not trust the Germans enough to inform them of the blow against the United States, which would fall the next day. But they were more worried than ever that Hitler would refrain from giving his guarantee unless Japan agreed to take on not only the United States and Great Britain, but the Soviet Union as well. In this predicament, Togo got off a long message to Ambassador Oshima in Berlin, urging him to somehow stall the Germans on the Russian matter and not to give in unless it became absolutely necessary. Deluded though they were about their ability to deal with the Americans and the British, the Japanese generals and admirals retained enough sense to realize that they could not fight the Russians at the same time, even with German help. Togo's instructions to Oshima on that fateful Saturday, December 6th, which are among the intercepted messages decoded by Secretary Hull's expert decipherers, give an interesting insight into the diplomacy practiced by the Nipponese with the Third Reich at the 11th hour. "We would like to avoid an armed clash with Russia until strategic circumstances permit it. So get the German government to understand this position of ours and negotiate with them so that at least for the present they will not insist upon exchanging diplomatic notes on this question. Explain to them at considerable length that insofar as American materials being shipped to Soviet Russia, they are neither of high quality nor of large quantity, and that in case we start our war with the United States we will capture all American ships destined for Soviet Russia. Please endeavor to come to an understanding on this line. However, should Ribbentrop insist upon our giving a guarantee in this matter, since in that case we shall have no other recourse, make a statement to the effect that we would, as a matter of principle, prevent war materials from being shipped from the United States to Soviet Russia via Japanese waters, and get them to agree to a procedure permitting the addition of a statement to the effect that, so long as strategic reasons continue to make it necessary for us to keep Soviet Russia from fighting Japan, what I mean is that we cannot capture Soviet ships, we cannot carry this out thoroughly. In case the German government refuses to agree with the above and makes their approval of this question absolutely conditional upon our participation in the war and upon our concluding a treaty against making a separate peace, we have no way but to postpone the conclusion of such a treaty." The Japanese need not have worried so much. For reasons unknown to the Tokyo militarists or to anyone else, and which defy logic and understanding, Hitler did not insist on Japan's taking on Russia along with the United States and Britain, though if he had, the course of the war conceivably might have been different. At any rate, the Japanese on this Saturday evening of December 6, 1941, were determined to strike a telling blow against the United States in the Pacific, though no one in Washington or Berlin knew just where or even exactly when. That morning, the British Admiralty had tipped off the American government that a large Japanese invasion fleet had been observed heading across the Gulf of Siam for the Isthmus of Kra, which indicated that the Nipponese were striking first at Thailand and perhaps Malaya. At 9 p.m., President Roosevelt got off a personal message to the Emperor of Japan, imploring him to join him in finding ways of dispelling the dark clouds, and at the same time warning him that a thrust of the Japanese military forces into Southeast Asia would create a situation that was unthinkable. At the Navy Department, intelligence officers drew up their latest report on the location of the major warships of the Japanese Navy. It listed most of them as being in home ports, including all the carriers and other warships of the task force, which, at that very moment, had steamed to within 300 miles of Pearl Harbor and was